Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Les plateformes de réalité virtuelle comme Resil aident les sportifs amateurs et professionnels à affiner leurs compétences pendant qu'ils récupèrent d'une blessure. Cela les aide à retourner sur le terrain avec confiance. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
After Oppenheimer's success at the Oscars, why not delve into the history of the atomic bomb and key characters from that period of history with a podcast? The Bomb from the BBC World Service explores the race to beat the Nazis in developing the atomic bomb and the scientists and spies who changed history. Listen to the whole series now by searching for The Bomb wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter is the award-winning podcast from the BBC World Service, full of thoughtful letters of advice, personal stories, and life lessons for daughters everywhere. Search for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 13th of March, these are our main stories. Washington says it expects a transitional council to be appointed in violent-hit Haiti soon after the resignation of the Prime Minister. The White House is sending $300 million in emergency aid to Ukraine, while a much larger package remains blocked by House Republicans. The EU's foreign policy chief says starvation is being used as an arm of war in Gaza. Also in this podcast.
The biggest problem, I think, in the happiness industry is that we've been getting the wrong message. People have been told to look after themselves and focus on themselves, but that's exactly the wrong thing you should be doing.
We show you the right path to bliss. We begin with the crisis in Haiti. The US State Department says it expects a transitional council in Haiti to be appointed within the next 48 hours. Once established, it will nominate a new prime minister to succeed Ariel Henry, who announced his plans to resign on Monday. A day later, at a media briefing, the US State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, said it had the support of the Biden administration.
We welcome yesterday's announcement of a transitional governance structure in Haiti, which paves the way for a peaceful transition of power, continuity of governance, and action plan for near-term security, including the deployment of a multinational security support mission and a pathway to free and fair elections. We commend Prime Minister Henri for his statesmanship in putting his country first and agreeing to step down when the transitional presidential council is established.
Security has yet to be improved in the Haitian capital, Port-au-Prince, since that resignation. Yves Rumbold is the director of communications at the think tank Policite. He told us about his life now in the capital.
We cannot stay in a city where we've been hearing, watching all types of violence. Where the gangs are controlling, I can tell you I don't go there. For the past 2 weeks, they have moved toward where I live, right? But now they have gained a lot of neighborhoods. They come, they burn the police stations, and then they move back to their headquarters. I'm worried as sick. We've even, you know, packed one small suitcase in case they come and then we don't know where to go. We're just going to grab the suitcase. That's the situation that I am right now in.
Well, it remains impossible to deliver essential goods to Port-au-Prince's residents. Hospitals and schools are closed and shops are running out of food. Plans to deploy a multinational security force to restore order have been put on hold by Kenya, which was to have led that mission. I heard the latest from our Central America and Caribbean correspondent, Will Grant.
Well, I'm in Dajabon, which is right on the border between the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and the border is now very, very firmly closed. There has been some movement during the day, but part of that movement is the deportation of undocumented Haitian migrants back to Haiti, back to a country that's in the grip of the worst humanitarian crisis it's experienced since the 2010 quake. There has been some movement in the other direction at some point during the day, but we didn't see any. We saw troops turning people away. But we can tell that, and we've spoken to people who say that they were able to come over in the morning just to get supplies. There's a sort of commercial area around the border where they were able to go to, but not, as it were, enter the Dominican Republic proper. And in the capital itself, well, the picture remains much the same, extremely violent, extremely dangerous, and largely controlled by the gangs.
And yet, after the resignation of the Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, the US State Department says it expects a transitional council in Haiti to be appointed within the next couple of days, and then they will nominate a new Prime Minister. It seems hard to see how that is possible. Who do you deal with? How does it come about?
Yeah, they've talked about the fact that they're in touch and they've held meetings with different stakeholders, as they put it, from members of the church to different political factions to civil society. But I think that kind of time frame seems extremely ambitious. In part, I think it was said with that kind of thinking because there was expectation or certainly hopes that an international force of, led by Kenyan personnel, around 1,000 Kenyan personnel, a force to tackle the gangs might be in place quite soon. But we've also seen that the Kenyan government has poured cold water on that happening without a sitting administration, even if it's a transitional one. So the whole situation remains very, very up in the air. It really is a sense of political limbo, a political vacuum, really, that these people are being deported back into.
And Will, Haiti has seen so much instability over the last 30 years in particular, an assassination recently of one president, another ousted a couple of times in the 90s and early 2000s. Do you think the situation right now is worse than it has ever been in the last few decades?
The thing is, I can't remember a degree of anarchy that was quite as this bad. I mean, obviously there was real, serious, horrendous humanitarian need after the earthquake. And of course, widespread looting, homelessness, you know, really, really dark days. It's important not to forget how bad that period was. But I think this sense of gang rule is the bit that I can't remember, the bit, the sort of complete absence of the state and the fact that the gangs dominate the capital by such a large extent, that police are being outnumbered and are losing all motivation, or perhaps even fleeing. We've heard reports of that in some cases. Looting is hard to keep under control.
Will Grant. Well, for more on the pressing humanitarian crisis, Tim Frank spoke to Jean-Martin Bauer, the Haiti country director for the World Food Programme. He's currently in the second city, Cap Haïtien.
Right now in Port-au-Prince, the World Food Program is able to provide some response to the crisis. Now, the crisis in Port-au-Prince has caused thousands of people to leave their homes. Overall in Haiti, there are 362,000 internally displaced people. Over the past weekend, about 15,000 new displaced people were identified. Their homes are burned, and they leave with a little more than the clothes on their back. And what we at the World Food Program have been doing is we've been running a hot meals program. We've been scaling it from about 7,000 meals a day. We've reached 12,000 meals a day. We'd like to get to 20,000 meals per day as soon as security and access conditions allow. We've also done dry rations in vulnerable parts of Port-au-Prince. Some neighborhoods have been under gang influence for years. And the day before yesterday, we were able to provide food rations to 4,000 people in Cité Soleil.
I'm sure that you're doing all that you can. Can you nonetheless give me some sense of how far you think it is meeting the need, how far you think it may be falling short?
The needs are quite high. And what we need is security. We need access. We need the shooting to stop. We need to be able to get to every single neighborhood in Port-au-Prince. What we're doing right now is helpful, but it's short of the need because of the fact that we have a very constrained environment.
Are you able to get any supplies in at the moment? For a long time, the gangs, they were in control of a lot of access points. But I mean, it seems as if they're in control completely now.
But what we're doing in Port-au-Prince is being run off stocks that we hold. So we still have stocks for some time, and we would be able to scale the response temporarily. The problem is we cannot renew and replenish these stocks. The port was looted just a few days ago. The road access to Port-au-Prince is very dangerous because armed groups control the major roads in and out of Port-au-Prince, and the international airport is closed. We're right now running a response on the basis of the stocks that we hold, and we're going to need to replenish fairly soon. What I'm worried about is that Port-au-Prince is a city where you've got 1.6 million people who are already facing a food crisis, and supplies are running out. We're seeing food prices rise. We're seeing very basic items run out, and that means that needs might outpace our ability to respond to them.
You said we may run out of stocks fairly soon, and I realise it's imprecise in the sense that, you know, it's contingent on lots of other things. But when you say fairly soon, what are you talking about? Days, weeks, months?
What I'm talking about is the fact that Haiti is extremely dependent on food imports. The statement wasn't really about WFP, but it's about how the food system works in Port-au-Prince. It's a big city. Even in the best times, Haiti depends on food imports for half of the food it consumes. It's a matter of days. The situation has already lasted for more than a week. We need the port to reopen. We need trade to resume in order to bring in fresh supplies into Port-au-Prince. The neighborhood of Cité Soleil, by the sea, faced about a year ago a brush with famine. 20,000 people in Cité Soleil were identified as facing famine-like conditions. And it shows how close we are to a disaster in Port-au-Prince.
That was Jean-Martin Bauer, Haiti Country Director for the World Food Programme. The White House National Security Advisor has announced $300 million in aid for Ukraine as a stopgap measure, while a much larger package remains stalled in Congress. Jake Sullivan said it would help with pressing needs, including artillery rounds. But his announcement came with a warning.
This ammunition will keep Ukraine's guns firing for a period, but only a short period. It is nowhere near enough to meet Ukraine's battlefield needs, and it will not prevent Ukraine from running out of ammunition in the weeks to come. It goes without saying, this package does not displace and should not delay the critical need to pass the bipartisan national security bill.
Jake Sullivan. Meanwhile, pro-Ukrainian fighters say they still hold Russian villages after a series of cross-border incursions. But Moscow says their attacks were repulsed after hours of fighting. Neither claim can be verified, but Russia has acknowledged there had been at least seven heavily armed assaults on Russian territory. Risto Piko reports.
Kyiv says the incursions were carried out by the Free Russia Legion, Russian volunteers fighting alongside Ukrainians. They appear to be supported by tanks and say that after clashes with Moscow's forces, they've taken control of villages in the border region. The Kremlin has denied this, but at the same time, schools in Kursk, some 50 kilometres into Russian territory, have been closed. Similar incursions have taken place in the past, but they haven't had a lasting impact. They are probably best seen as Ukrainian efforts to destabilize Moscow through asymmetrical warfare, just like the widespread drone strikes overnight.
Risto Piko. The EU's foreign policy chief has said starvation is being used as an arm of war in Gaza. Josep Borrell described the lack of aid entering the territory as a man-made disaster. Earlier, the British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, urged Israel to open one of its main cargo ports to seaborne aid deliveries destined for Gaza, amid warnings of an impending famine. And he said even more measures were needed.
Israel must open more land routes, including in the north, for longer and with fewer screening requirements. I've been clear, we need an immediate humanitarian pause to increase aid into Gaza and get the hostages out. Israel must remove restrictions on aid and restore electricity, water and telecommunications.
UN officials have welcomed the opening of a new maritime aid corridor being used by a Spanish ship, which has left Cyprus for Gaza, but say it's nowhere near enough. I heard more from Mark Lowen, our correspondent in Jerusalem.
What we know is that this ship has left Cyprus. It's going slowly, 3 knots an hour. We know, first of all, that it is carrying rice, flour, protein, beans, meat, apparently. And this is from an American aid organisation called World Central Kitchen. It's being carried on a boat belonging to the Spanish NGO Open Arms. It is bound for Gaza. Now, where does it actually go and how does it offload? What is happening at the moment is that there are some teams from that NGO building a jetty somewhere off the Gazan coast for the ship to dock. Now, the jetty's been built with rubble from some of the destroyed buildings over the last 5 months of war. The longer-term plan, which is a separate mission, is that the Americans are sending another ship to build a more permanent pier, which aid ships would be able to dock at, and then a causeway, which smaller ships would be able to come to in order to take the aid from the larger aid ships, and then basically take that to land, and then vehicles would drive it into Gaza. But there are a huge number of questions over who would provide the security with those vehicles going into Gaza. You know, when aid, much needed aid, is distributed to starving, desperate people, It's not a simple process.
So, Mark, it sounds as though from what you're saying with regards to the security of aid deliveries, regardless of how the aid gets in by sea or by land, that is key, isn't it?
Mm. It is, yeah, Nick. I mean, this is a territory that is in its sixth month of war, where not only have 80% of the population been displaced, tens of thousands of people killed, according to the local health officials, but there are no local structures in place, really, in vast parts of the territory. So the police force in northern Gaza, for example, is just not present. So the northern part of Gaza, which is the most desperately in need of aid, where Gazan health officials are saying that at least 25 children have now died from famine and dehydration, there are just no structures in place there, really, to distribute the aid, which is why you saw those tragic scenes a couple of weeks ago of the stampede, Palestinians saying that Israelis shot at them, the Israelis saying that actually it was a mob that was kind of run over by aid trucks and stuff. So it's a huge, huge challenge.
That was Mark Lowen. The Burundian sports team Dynamo is out of the Basketball Africa League. Not for its lack of skill on the court, but because of a row over the logos on the team shirts. Rwanda sponsors the league, and that's turned a sports story into one with deeply political overtones. I heard more from Will Ross, our Africa regional editor.
The shirts of this team, Dynamo, who were playing in this basketball tournament in South Africa, had the logo on them of Visit Rwanda, as all the other teams did in the tournament. But for the game on Saturday, when they played against a team from Cape Town, the Cape Town Tigers, this Burundian team decided to cover up the Visit Rwanda logo. And for that, they received a two-match suspension. And then it transpires that under the rules, if you're suspended for two games within the same tournament, you're then not allowed to continue. So the team has to now travel home. And this is really all about a long-running row between Burundi and Rwanda. People may know this Visit Rwanda slogan. It's something that the Arsenal football team have on the sleeves of their shirts, which has been a slightly controversial sponsorship deal. In this case, Rwanda's kind of been at the forefront of promoting basketball in Africa, and Burundi has accused Rwanda of supporting rebels that have carried out attacks inside Burundi, something that Kigali denies. So it looks like a kind of political manoeuvre by Burundi in order to perhaps raise some attention about this problem they have with Rwanda, because presumably they would have known going into the tournament that these were the shirts, this is what you've got to wear.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're reading perhaps into it motives from Burundian to make a political statement.
There's obviously some frustration at all of this, because as the Dynamo's American player Brighton Hobbs said, it was pretty clear that there would have been contracts involved. This wasn't a sudden punishment imposed without Burundi kind of knowing what they're doing, and he suggested that actually the Burundian government had told the team to do this. So, yes, it once again highlights the tension in the Great Lakes region, and it's all come to the surface at this basketball tournament.
Will Ross. Still to come.
France is the largest consumer of frogs' legs, and we import about 3,000 tons every year.
Now, this famous French dish is attracting controversy.
Hi, I'm Sophia Smith-Gaylor.
And I'm Saatchi Kaul.
And we're the hosts of a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service, Where to Be a Woman. So, what's the podcast about, Saatchi?
It's all about where in the world women are living their best lives, what female wellness looks like globally, and what the rest of us may be able to learn from it.
And where can people find it?
Just search for Where to Be a Woman wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And follow or subscribe so you never miss an episode.
After Oppenheimer's success at the Oscars, why not delve into the history of the atomic bomb and key characters from that period of history with a podcast? The Bomb, from the BBC World Service, explores the race to beat the Nazis in developing the atomic bomb and the scientists and spies who changed history. Listen to the whole series now by searching for The Bomb wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The US special counsel, who released a scathing report last month suggesting President Biden had a poor memory, has been giving testimony at a congressional hearing. Robert Hur, originally a Republican appointee, defended his report after Mr. Biden criticized his findings. Mr. Hur was investigating classified documents found at the president's home. He said Mr. Biden appeared to have no memory of how they got there. Testifying before the hearing, Mr. Hur said he was simply doing his job.
My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the attorney general my decision and the reasons for it. That's what I was required to do.
Our Washington correspondent Nomi Iqbal was on Capitol Hill, where she listened to the congressional hearing.
Special Prosecutor Robert Hur finds himself a rare unifying figure. Republicans and Democrats are angry with him. Republicans wanted him to charge Mr. Biden, and Democrats are furious over how he made the president's age and cognitive abilities, a weak point with voters, a focus in his report. They have accused Mr. Hur of being partisan, a claim made at the hearing by the Democrat Congressman Hank Johnson.
You are a Republican, though, aren't you?
I am a registered Republican.
And you're doing everything you can do to get President Trump reelected so that you can get appointed as a federal judge or perhaps to another position in the Department of Justice. Isn't that correct?
Congressman, I have no such aspirations. I can assure you, partisan politics had no place whatsoever in my work.
Republicans are looking for evidence that Mr. Hur was under political pressure not to charge the president, claiming that the case is similar to the classified documents prosecution Donald Trump is facing. Mr. Hur said his investigation's findings did not meet the bar for criminal prosecution, and he could not determine whether Mr. Biden had willfully retained and disclosed sensitive documents without addressing the president's state of mind.
Nomi Iqbal in Washington. Iraq's agriculture ministry says half of the country's farmland has now been abandoned due to an ongoing drought. The UN has ranked Iraq as one of the countries worst affected by climate change. Here's Mike Thompson.
Many Middle Eastern countries are suffering from droughts, but few as badly as Iraq. Rainfall there is at its lowest in 40 years, leaving vast swathes of agricultural land parched and useless. Last year, the country's president, Mohammed Shia al-Sudani, said climate change was affecting more than 7 million Iraqis. Much of Iraq's water comes from the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. Both originate in Turkey, which has built dozens of dams along them, reducing flow to already water-starved Iraq.
Mike Thompson. China's largest producer of bottled water, Nongfu Spring, has come under attack for not being patriotic enough. The company has been criticised for its packaging looking too Japanese. And there's also a tale of a rivalry with another bottled water company. Some have started to boycott Nongfu Spring's products and shares in the company have fallen. I heard more from our Asia Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow.
The attack on Nongfu Spring appears to have started last month when a rival bottled water company, the owner of that company, died. Now, he was very well respected. He was respected primarily for being a patriot. He loved China. And since then, people have compared him to the owner of Nongfu Spring. The owner of Nongfu Spring, by the way, is China's richest man, Zhong Shanshan, worth about $60 billion. A couple of things that they've pointed out. One, that the owner's son appears to have a US citizenship, so that's not really patriotic. Also, some of the packaging, people have pointed out, appears to be Japanese-inspired. Some of the temples which appears on the packaging looks like Japanese temples, not Chinese temples. And as lots of people must now be aware, China doesn't always like Japan. And so that's seen as unpatriotic as well. So it doesn't seem really logical. It doesn't seem as though there's a great deal behind this. But when you get this national sentiment moving, not much does need to be behind it for all these people to come across and start criticising.
What's the company itself had to say about this?
Quite early on, Zhong Shanshan himself came out because one of the criticisms was that he'd tried to undermine his rival when his rival was still alive. He came out, Zhong Shanshan, and said, no, that's not the case. I respected him. We were both in a competitive business. We both fought hard but respected each other. So he's tried to neuter this campaign against his company. The provincial government where his company is based has also said, look, this is really silly to try and attack one of our great companies. So they've tried to stop it as well. But at the moment, they haven't had much success.
Has this kind of thing happened in the past? Companies being attacked for allegedly not being nationalistic enough?
It happens all the time in China. I have to say it's usually foreign companies. Perhaps they've listed, for example, Taiwan as an independent country on their website. Taiwan, the Chinese believe, is part of their own territory. Or perhaps a country is subject to a political campaign by the government in China, and so companies from that country will be attacked. So it happens all the time. Not as often is it directed against a Chinese company. The speed with which this has happened shows that it can happen at lightning pace. It isn't always logical, but it can cause immense damage to your company.
Mickey Bristow. Next to France, where frog's legs have been part of the national diet for more than 1,000 years. Now, though, this famous French dish is attracting controversy. Wildlife groups are complaining that the thousands of frozen frog legs which France imports is leading some species to decline. More than 500 scientists have written a letter to the French president, Emmanuel Macron, to, in their words, end the over-exploitation of these amphibious creatures. Vivienne Nunis spoke to Charlotte Nittard from the French NGO Robin des Bois, who is one of those leading the call to protect frogs.
France is the largest consumer of frogs' legs, and we import about 3,000 tons every year. And these frogs are mainly coming from Indonesia, Turkey and Albania. 3,000 tons, it represents about 60 to 150 million frogs, depending on their size.
So presumably that's far more than the number of frogs in France. Is that why they're imported?
They are imported because capturing frogs in France is prohibited. Mainly frog species in Europe and in France are protected. And that's why the market switched to imports when frogs have been protected in France. We imported them from India and Bangladesh. And these two countries banned at the end of the 80s the export because they witnessed that the over-exploitation of frogs was causing a collapse of frogs population and also some invasion of mosquitoes and crop pests, and then an increase of use of pesticides. So then the market switched to Indonesia, Turkey and Albania.
Yes, and what do you say, and what do the other wildlife groups say that has done to frog populations in those countries?
Step by step, there is a domino effect. The hunters are targeting one species for its huge legs, and then this species is disappearing, and then another species is target, and then another country is target, another area is target. And step by step, we witness a significant decline of this population, and it has huge ecological effect because frogs are natural insects controllers. They eat a lot of mosquitoes, and it has an impact on the use of pesticides, etc. So that's why frogs are helpers for humanity, and we should protect them and not eat them.
And what are you calling on President Macron to do?
We are calling him to take France's responsibility and to initiate protection of the most traded frog species. And we think that France should take the lead and should draft some proposal in order at least to control the trade, because nowadays it's totally out of control.
And how are people in France reacting to this? Because we outside the country have always associated frogs' legs as a famous part of French cuisine. Is it still very popular?
So it's still popular, less and less, but unfortunately it's still popular. But what we know is that people totally lack of information. They are astonished when we inform them about where the frogs are coming from. They are totally surprised when we inform them that it comes from Indonesia, etc. So there is a lack of information. So that's why also we, with scientists and other NGOs, we are campaigning in order to inform the consumers about what they are doing. We know that the market is less and less popular, but unfortunately it's still popular because some people try to push the nostalgia of frogs' legs and to create some new event with frogs' legs on the plate and some festival of frogs' legs. Some people are trying to revigorate this trade.
Charlotte Nithard from the French NGO Robin des Bois. We're often told that in order to be happy, we must look inwards, usually under the banner of self-care. But a new study suggests, amongst other things, that maybe we should be looking outwards. The study, which followed 230 people over 2 years, also came up with a list of things almost guaranteed to improve our mood. Stephanie Prentice has been reading it. I asked her, why should we pay attention to this study?
Well, Nick, you're absolutely not wrong. We do hear a lot about happiness from the wellness industry, from the neuroscience community, and from these sort of studies that combine the two. And given the sometimes ephemeral nature of feeling happy, it can be hard to turn those learnings into practical behaviours. But that's what this study set out to do. It's evidence-based, it's out of Bristol University in southern England, and it runs a 10-week course where students build daily habits. A lot of them will have seen celebrated already on social media, like getting outside in nature, expressing gratitude, meditating, journaling. But perhaps unsurprisingly, the students they asked 2 years later, who still practice those habits daily, they reported being 10 to 15% happier. And while that might seem obvious that they would be, there were other less obvious findings.
That we should have chocolate cake or anything like that on a daily basis?
I mean, we absolutely should. That can't be argued with. But actually, let's take a quick listen to the man who led the study. His name is Bruce Hood. He's a professor and the author of the book, The Science of Happiness.
I mean, the biggest problem, I think, in the happiness industry is that we've been getting the wrong message. People have been told to look after themselves and focus on themselves. But that's exactly the wrong thing you should be doing. You should be trying to share your joy and connect with other people. And, you know, just generally connecting with other people is really the route to happiness.
He also says be less selfish, focus on helping others. And if we just rattle through the list he compiled from his findings, it says talk to strangers, give people gifts. Apparently that activates more reward centres than buying something for yourself. And as an adjacent point to that, he says loneliness impacts physical health because it impairs our immune systems. Regular activities that provide connection, like joining a choir or a sports team, are also recommended. Sleep is critical to happiness levels. Perhaps the most surprising is social media. Now, we often see that linked to negative mental health. It's not bad for everyone, the study says, just those who, you guessed it, focus on themselves. And critically, he said, happiness maintenance is like going to the gym. You've got to do it regularly to see those good results.
Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
After Oppenheimer's success at the Oscars, why not delve into the history of the atomic bomb and key characters from that period of history with a podcast? The Bomb from the BBC World Service explores the race to beat the Nazis in developing the atomic bomb and the scientists and spies who changed history. Listen to the whole series now by searching for The Bomb wherever you get your BBC podcasts.